Toni Bond-Leonard, and she's going to talk about the Hyde Amendment.
Good morning. Again, I'm Toni Bond-Leonard. I am the board chair of the National Network of Abortion Funds and president and CEO of African American Women Evolving, which is a member of the National Network of Abortion Funds. We have a small fund. I have no financial relationships to disclose. An overview of my presentation. When women of color and poor women and immigrant women and young women are really denied access to funding for abortions, we're really talking about denying them their fundamental human right. And every year, women are, thousands of women who are from these populations are denied access to abortion because they don't have the financial resources to pay for them. And that is really owing to the Hyde Amendment, which I will talk about when we go further along. And because of that, because they don't have the money to get their abortions, they end up having to make some pretty drastic sacrifices in terms of their basic life necessities, like food for their families, clothing, putting off paying their rent, not paying their utilities, all to come up with the money to get an abortion. So I'm going to talk about the impact of abortion funding, or the lack thereof, on low-income women, women of color, immigrant women. And then I'm going to talk about the state and national advocacy efforts to restore public funding for abortion, and talk about the National Network of Abortion Funds and its member funds. But I want to frame this in the context of more than just abortion access, because this is really about reproductive justice. And as you see here, I have a definition of reproductive justice, because abortion access is really just one component to ending the reproductive oppression in the lives of women. In 1994, a group of black women came up with the term reproductive justice as a way to really highlight the intersectionalities of race, class, and gender. That term was subsequently taken and fleshed out and defined even more by a group called Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice. And the definition they came up with was that reproductive justice is the complete physical, mental, spiritual, political, economic, and social well-being of women and girls, and will be achieved when women and girls have the economic, social, and political power and resources to make healthy decisions about our bodies, sexuality, and reproduction for ourselves, our families, and our communities in all areas of our lives. And this really, I think, speaks to what the issue of abortion funding or abortion access for low-income women is really all about, because it's more than just being able to go and get the abortion, being able to go to a clinic. And it's even more than just about being able to come up with the money. But when we really kind of break this apart and look at the women who are impacted the most, for instance, women of color, are disproportionately represented among low-income women, and especially African-American women. And when we talk about young women and their unique place in this discussion and how they're impacted, most young women rely upon the support of their parents. And so when they become pregnant, they have to make a tough decision in terms of, you know, can they tell their parent, what will happen? Will they get thrown out of the house? Some young women, will they be beaten? Just lots and lots of consequences to disclosing information to their parents about being pregnant. And, of course, uninsured immigrant women and undocumented women, do they risk, deportation for, you know, going to the clinic or something like that. This is my attempt to show you, in my mind, the slow erosion of rights for women. So as you see at the very top here, we started out on the right foot with the 1973 landmark decision in Roe v. Wade, which held that women had the fundamental right to obtain an abortion. And when Roe v. Wade was decided, poor women who qualified for health care through Medicaid had their abortions covered just as any other medical care that they needed. And then we had the Hyde Amendment in 1976. And this is where it all started to fall apart, which is that Henry Hyde, former Representative Henry Hyde from my home state of Illinois, got his amendment passed that really took away funding for poor women through Medicaid. And basically, the Hyde Amendment bans federal Medicaid funding for abortion. Over the years, it has been, so they say, loosened in 2003, it was loosened to include medical necessity, and right now it only covers rape, incest, or life endangerment. And you'll see as I talk further how it doesn't even really play out that way for women who live in certain states. And then, of course, over the years, we have more and more restrictions, like mandatory waiting periods for young women, parental consent or parental notification, and then even more restrictions, like around conscience clauses, where people who work at facilities that perform abortions can opt out of participating in that abortion service any kind of way. Even the receptionist could refuse to make the appointment. So when we talk about abortion in the context of reproductive justice, we really need to talk about the economics of abortion for low-income women. The average first trimester abortion costs $400 and up. And when you talk about someone who is only getting, you know, three something a month in monthly public assistance, that's really unrealistic. She's got to pull money from those meager resources that she's getting every month to try and come up with this amount. And because she's unable to do that, many women transition into the second trimester, which costs anywhere from $500 and up to thousands of dollars. Then if she is in need of a second trimester abortion, usually those are 2 to 3 day procedures, and so she has to factor in the cost of transportation to maybe catch a bus or catch a train. And if, for instance, in Illinois, parts of downstate Illinois, if a woman needs a second or third, second trimester abortion, she needs hotel costs. So she needs money to stay at the hotel, and then these other ancillary costs. She can't just stay at the hotel and not have food. She's got to have food. And if she has other children, she needs to have child care, and so she has to pay for child care. So in 1993, a group called the National Network of Abortion Funds was created, which is an association of 104 grassroots community-based groups in 43 states, the District of Columbia, and Canada that have come together to help low-income women with the money that they need for safe abortions. And as you can see, each year, the member funds of the network collectively give out about $2.6 million in financial assistance to women. A little bit about the abortion funds. As I said, we provide direct financial assistance to women for first and second trimester abortions, but some of us provide what we call practical support assistance, which is help with a bus ticket or a train ticket. We'll pay for hotel stay. Some of us will pay for child care. Some of us will help out with money for food. most of us fun in our geographical area in our state. But because the need is so great, some funds will help out with national support. We have about three funds that do some national funding. Some of us also help with money for emergency contraception, for money for the ultrasound. We also give referrals for housing, referrals for domestic violence counseling, referrals for sexual assault counseling, help with applying for Medicaid. And we have to do these kind of referrals because oftentimes when women contact the funds, they don't come just with the need of getting an abortion, but they may come because they are pregnant as a result of sexual assault, or they may be homeless, or they may be in a domestically violent situation. And so we find that we have to help them work through all of these other issues as well as getting their abortion. Most of us are volunteer funds. Some of us do have staff. My fund in Illinois does have a staff, and so we're able to do a little more work in terms of education and advocacy work. Most of us get our support from individual donors. Very few of us get private foundation support. Our support comes from concerned community citizens who believe that low-income women should have access to abortion just like a woman with economic means. Most of us are small grassroots groups that were formed within other progressive organizations. Maybe we've been formed within a church or within a women's group. Some of us are clinic-based funds. Some of us are funds housed right within local Planned Parenthoods. As I said earlier, the government's denial of abortion services to low-income women really means that they have to deny themselves and their families of basic life necessities. So that means taking money from the rent and possibly risking eviction, not paying your utilities. And if they may already be behind in their light bill or their gas bill, deciding to put the utility off for another month may put their utilities at risk of being cut off. Or they may decide that they're not going to buy as much food for this month. Or they may decide that, decide they're going to try and borrow money from a friend or family member who might already have, few economic resources, but they find that they have to do that and then have to go into further debt because they have got to pay this debt or pay this loan back. Okay, well, I went too far ahead. So a little about righting the wrongs of Hyde. The funds are really, some of the funds are involved in state-based advocacy work, which includes working to increase Medicaid reimbursement rates, decreasing reimbursements or delays, campus and youth organizing. For instance, my fund does some policy and advocate training for grassroots activists to become involved in civic participation. And also challenging illegal Medicaid denials. We have funds in Maine, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Philadelphia that are working specifically around challenging Medicaid denials. For example, in Illinois, we're working around, one, trying to increase the reimbursement rate, and two, trying to get them to actually reimburse clinics. We have one clinic that funded a rape survivor 2 years ago, and they're still waiting on their reimbursement. And at the national level, the network has launched a campaign called Hyde 30 Years is Enough, and it really is a call for the public funding of abortion as a part of comprehensive health care for all women. And the coalition, it's a coalition, it's really a diverse coalition of groups, all who believe that low-income women need to have access to the full range of reproductive health care, including abortion services. And some of those groups who are part of that coalition include Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collaborative, the ACLU, NARAL, the National Abortion Federation, and Planned Parenthood. Some of the things that the campaign has done is to collect names for a petition saying that, you know, telling Congress that we need to repeal the Hyde Amendment. And in January of this year, the campaign, coalition partners, and some of the member funds went to D.C. and delivered the petitions to members of Congress, and they were all kind of divided up based upon zip codes, so each congressperson had names from their zip codes. The campaign is kind of on hold now because we're waiting to see what's going to happen with the election. And the coalition has worked to come up with some strategies around trying to get the Hyde Amendment repealed, including a bill or a resolution. But again, we need to kind of see what's going to happen with the election and who our new administration is going to be. Some of the work that the network does and additional advocacy and policy. It's published an advocate's toolkit to help member funds develop advocacy campaigns, flyers and fact sheets and talking points about the Hyde Amendment, a policy report about abortion funding, which really expounds upon abortion access within a reproductive justice context. It gives small grants to member funds to carry out advocacy and policy initiatives, and it has a toolkit about how to start an abortion fund for folks who are interested in starting an abortion fund in their local area. And that concludes my presentation. If you want to reach the network, you can call them at 617-524-6040 or visit us at NNAF.org about information on starting a fund or getting involved with a campaign. Thank you.
Great, thank you very much. And now we'll spend the remaining time with questions. We're going to open it up to the floor. And actually, I have two questions I would like to start out. One is for Dr. Arguello. When you were talking about the suicides, and then when I heard Melody's presentation, I was wondering, are those real suicides, or could those be results of self-induced abortions gone awry?
Basically, because they take that with the idea that they will lose the pregnancy.
So then maybe it's not a true suicide. It could be.
Part of.
Yeah.
Part of that could be the other part is because, young people see problems like it's a huge problem. Maybe not a huge problem, but from his own experience. It's a huge problem, so they don't see any way out.
Yeah. Okay. And then when I was hearing about the two H amendments, the Helms Amendment and the Hyde, I was wondering, is there a way, or I don't know if this is happening, but that national groups working to repeal Hyde are coming together with folks that are working internationally to overturn the Helms to work together in strategy, in collaboration? So.
You've exposed my secret plan.
Oh, okay.
I'd say we're not doing that yet. International groups have not really coalesced around the Helms Amendment. Obviously, IPAS focuses on abortion. This is our biggest priority for the coming year, and we're also a member of the Hyde campaign and do a little bit of work in the U.S. So what I'd like to see is coming together to end abortion funding bans, period, all of them, and then to see groups work together, because we're basically talking about the same women, the poorest women in any given country who are suffering from these bans, and also the same human rights and reproductive justice perspective coming from some of the groups, and so I'm hoping that that will happen.
And it's taken a while for us to even get to the point where we were going to actively attempt to try and repeal the Hyde Amendment, because for so long it was thought as a losing battle, that it's not the right time given the current administration, or we'll never win this fight. But there was such a huge push from the network and its member abortion funds and many women of color groups saying, to say that it's a losing fight for us to attempt to repeal Hyde speaks volumes to what we think about the lives of low-income women. And so are we saying that those lives are not worth, even engaging in a fight to try and repeal the Hyde Amendment? So it's been years to get to this point. So it doesn't take
questions, anyone?
A question about Nicaragua. Do you have any idea how many legal abortions were performed before your law was changed to be so restrictive?
Well, the abortion was forbidden always in Nicaragua, except for therapeutic abortion. And therapeutic abortion is about 1% of the total abortion in Nicaragua. We do not have any data of the, you know, how many abortions are doing, let's say, illegal out of the hospital, out of the private clinics. We don't have that information. And the problem we have right now is that women who really need therapeutic abortion do not have access to. And what's really happening in the hospital is that they are trying to wait until you pass the 20 week of pregnancy, then they induce the abortion. Well, they induce the delivery, let's say, not the abortion. And of course, the fetus will not survive. That's what they do. That's the trick that these doctors are doing. But the main problem is that we are increasing the exposure of risk of a woman who is pregnant. And on the other hand, the woman also is afraid. Is afraid because if she has a vaginal bleeding, is afraid to go to a public hospital because she can be accused. She can be accused up from 3 to 6 years, and with the physician can be accused from up to 8 years in jail, plus we lost a license for 6 years. Six years after we leave the jail. So it's basically we lost our profession. So everybody's really afraid of. So everybody's like, you know, you came as a patient, I prefer that she see you, so I try to delay you. And all that takes a lot increase the risk of having any kind of complications. I personally long use of health 2 ultrasound because the women were dying because the doctors don't want to do anything if they don't have an ultrasound. You know, before that you do that at clinic. Now they want to have an ultrasound, they have a picture, they want to be sure that they have the information that the embryo or fetus is not alive to perform the abortion. So, you know, I did that, 2 equipment. Maybe the cost was about $80,000. Both equipment are destroyed right now. So that's the situation we have.
Another question. Has this restriction affected the treatment of ectopic pregnancies? I've heard of some Catholic hospitals in the U.S. where they have decided treating an ectopic is like doing an abortion. Even though the woman could die.
Yeah. We don't have any problem with that right now. But when we discussed that, the people from the group, this pro-life, they say that that's not abortion. And we say, well, it is abortion. Because, you know, anything that is before the 20 week of pregnancy is abortion. So, but that is a discussion about that. The problem of this is that, you know, what will happen if you have ectopic pregnancy, and then a woman comes to the hospital with pain and bleeding. You know, it will depend on the physician, it will depend on the skills of the physician to understand that that's a patient who has ectopic pregnancy, or he can delay the patient because she's bleeding, and he believes he's having some kind of, abortion, so he delayed that. So that's the problem we have. And we know that the government gave the order to keep quiet with the maternal mortality, so it's kind of hard because you don't know, you know, what's going on. It's kind of hard to have the data to know exactly what is going on. And the government knows this. I mean, they eliminate therapeutic abortion just to please the church, the Catholic Church, that's it. And because they have a business together. But they don't care about human rights. Before I came here and I thought that maybe they would stop me on the immigration, they say that anybody who was fighting the ban is a person who will go into jail because we are promoting abortion in Nicaragua. And we say we're not promoting abortion. What we're doing is defending the human rights. But the law is in the side of the government, so there is no justice there. So we still have that problem in our heads, but we keep doing what we're doing. You know, we need to increase the awareness. We need to talk more about this, the congressmen, the majority of them, they agree with this because they don't vote as a rational vote. They vote because if the party says, you know, this is the right way to vote, they just vote like rational people. Ectopic pregnancy is surgical.
Surgical, though.
Yeah.
That's not in actual conflict with the Catholic position on intervention, the double
effect. That, no.
Dan is talking about, which is really true here, or
yeah. No, there is no problem with Catholic Church about that. What we believe is the next step of the Catholic Church will be to eliminate the pill of the day after, after pill, and the view also, the intrauterine device. Because the intrauterine device is a micro, it gives micro abortion. So we believe that's the next step. And we're seeing this in El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And so we're seeing that they're moving forward to eliminate those. The same thing. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard.
Yeah.
And we know that there are nurses and doctors that there is a network of people who belong to this pro-life, that's a Catholic Church organization, and this pro-life, they send information.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I remember I went all over the country to explain doctors about what therapeutic abortion means, because it is amazing. Health workers and doctors, they don't have any idea what therapeutic abortion is. It's just amazing. I mean, I remember maybe the worst place that I've been there, doctor were saying that, you know, a girl who is in the rural area, who's living in the countryside, she knows that when she's gonna get pregnant. Since they are little girls, she see the cow and the bull having sex, and then, you know, the cow get pregnant, so they know that. When coming from a physician, it's just amazing. I mean, this is the extreme. So what I learned in giving talks for more than 1,000 persons is that they don't know anything, that we need to train our own staff, and second, that the population doesn't know anything, and third, that there is a part where the physicians know that there is a group of, so they keep quiet, so they don't talk, they don't express what they think. That's what is happening, and everybody's afraid.
I mean, a lot of professional pressure, even within the medical.
Yeah.
What about in Africa?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can talk about two, though. One thing is in El Salvador, let's see if there's an Afghan colleague that might know about this more than I do, but I'll just mention that in El Salvador, where there's also a total abortion ban, there have been cases, a lot of cases, where doctors are reporting women who have shown up at the hospitals with complications of unsafe abortion, and then the women have been arrested because of that, and we're working on a study right now to see how judges are interpreting that. So when the woman is in front of the judge in court, judges, it's kind of ambiguous in the law whether the provider has a duty to report or a duty under medical ethics to keep it confidential. And so we're And then another horrible example is Kenya, and that happened, I think, about 2 years ago, where there's a very strong, organized anti-choice community in Kenya, and there were fetuses found, actually, in the streets of Kenya, and a Kenyan doctor who had provided an abortion and two nurses were actually arrested and charged with abortion in connection to those found fetuses. And no one really, and there wasn't a true connection, and no one really knows how they made that connection, but it's sort of suspected that they were planted in a way, this doctor in particular was targeted. So there's an alliance of organizations in Kenya called the Reproductive Health and Rights Alliance who worked to defend the doctor and the nurses and were ultimately successful. So I think it's sort of, it's not very straightforward really anywhere. I mean, there's so many different interests. Doctors' interest, doctors' fear, patients' fear, strong anti-choice, and a lot of bias on the part of government officials, prosecutors, and then also the medical community as well. So it's all these sort of different interests interacting, and I think the result is that it's totally unpredictable what's going to happen in any given country. We just hope and try to equip advocacy communities with the tools to be able to defend women or defend providers in those situations.
Regarding El Salvador, if any woman comes into a hospital and she's bleeding, the first thing the doctor has to say, it has to call the police. And so they put the patient in another room and there's a police in the door.
Really?
Yeah, that's what they do in El Salvador. We don't have that.
For any woman that comes in?
For any woman. So it's like, you're guilty, you're guilty at the beginning.
Because I was going to ask about misoprostol. In the U.S. we've been seeing a lot of women from the Caribbean and Latin America who are using Cytotec, and I'm wondering, do you see an underground, but then in El Salvador,
In Nicaragua, you can buy it without any prescription, but people don't know how to manage that. It's like the pill of the day after. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of misuse. It's, girls who are taking pills to avoid getting pregnant and they take the pills again and again and again without any knowledge.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder if that's a way to really increase access for women in these countries. It seems like really focusing on educating pharmacists, is one thing, but also to use that as an opportunity to educate women to try and get around some of these very restrictive places.
And we're working on that, but that really ties into your former question, in that IPATH is an international organization. We work very closely with governments. In most places, we're working with governments, or we're working with governments to make access, to increase access to post-abortion care, and so we're not an organization who's going to do clandestine work to, but at the same time, the law is not that clear. I mean, is it okay to train pharmacists to how to administer Cytotec or misoprostol correctly? We don't know, and so actually what we're doing is we're undertaking studies in several countries. It'll be, I think, 15 countries in the next 2 years to get lawyers to kind of look at that question, and not only that question, but also will the authorities have a problem with that? So a lot of places where we work, the law is not that clear. Maybe there even just isn't that many laws, so we're sort of trying to figure that out and figure out what we can do without exposing ourselves and providers and also women that we serve to risks of prosecution. But it's definitely a strategy of training, a lot of different places. I happen to know Kenya and Mexico where we've done studies to find out that, yes, women are going to pharmacy
There was a question back there at the beginning. Yeah.
I was wondering if you found that if they are helpful in the movement, or as part of some practices are probably explaining that they know that people are using it for whatever it's intended for, or if they're withholding it from anyone, so they think might be using it, or if that's
I'll try to answer this based on two studies that I've read, so I'm far from the expert, but I'll just mention that. Well, in Kenya anyway, it's been sort of half and half of the pharmacies. In a study that we did to ask pharmacies, are you providing misoprostol, or how are you providing it? And it was sort of half of the pharmacists were completely against it and wouldn't provide it, and then half of them would be helpful. And then in Mexico, I believe, I'm not sure if you can speak to this, Maria. I believe that pharmacists are being cooperative. Do you know more about that study and that work in Mexico? That you
not really know.
Okay. We're a big organization.
And I know there's been conversation about framing some of the training and management issues in terms of miscarriage management, and I'm wondering if that is something, you know, in terms of training or even like being able to buy the equipment, like having the buy the equipment to manage miscarriages.
I mean, I think in some places we're training people on post-abortion care with the idea that one day the law will be reformed, and then one day in the future when abortion is legal, they can provide services. And similarly with, with misoprostol in countries where abortion is restricted, training providers on the range of uses of misoprostol for miscarriage management, for other obstetric uses, and then also abortion. So just sort of couching it on which makes more sense anyway, in a wider range of reproductive health services. It really, and I think that really kind of emphasizes this strange thing of illegalizing or making illegal and banning a certain procedure. I mean, if we're just talking about trying to improve health, you provide training on a range of services, all the services, but instead you sort of have to figure out how to do this piecemeal approach. But we're not explicitly sort of training people in restrictive settings and, mm-hmm. and saying that you can also do this for abortion, because we work so closely with governments and so firmly within existing laws.
Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Well, thank you everyone for coming on the third and last day of the conference, and thank you for our presenters. It was really, really interesting. And I think the idea of tying this domestic to the international, like that advocacy.
So India is one of the
Thank you.